Good morning. May it please the court, my name is Jonathan Levine and I appear on behalf of the plaintiff appellant, Metropolitan Milwaukee Association of Commerce. The district court held that MMAC challenged to Chapter 31 of the General Ordinance of Milwaukee County was not right. In doing so, the district court misapplied the settled standard for evaluating summary judgment motions and ignored material fact which established the existence of a live, focused Article 3 case or controversy in search of a court that will hear it. We ask that the district court's decision be reversed and that this court grant MMAC's motion for summary judgment on the merits. Rule 56C allowed the district court to grant the county's motion only if the record evidence showed that there was no genuine issue of material fact and that the county was entitled to a judgment as a matter of law. The burden of proof was on the county, and the court was required to view all disputed facts and draw all inferences in a light most favorable to the non-moving party, MMAC. We believe that the district court barely paid lip service to these requirements, and as a result, missed the mark in the conclusion that it ultimately reached. The district court held that the county's motion turned on an application of the two-pronged balancing test in Abbott Laboratories. That point is debatable because the issue in Abbott was whether a pure pre-enforcement challenge was ripe. This case challenges the county's actual enforcement of Chapter 31 in addition to its threat of future enforcement.
Mr. Levine, given that none of the plaintiffs has yet been approached by a union, is there a danger that if we reach the merits of your case now, we'll be doing so in a vacuum and on speculation about how this particular ordinance might operate without, you know, the benefit of any concrete facts we would have if we would wait until a union actually triggered the Chapter 31 provision?
Judge, I'm not aware of any fact that would inform this court's decision on whether or not Chapter 31 on its face is preempted or unconstitutional. Chapter 31, after all, instructs the players involved what has to occur, not what can occur. There are certain mandatory requirements of Chapter 31 that must occur when a union requests a labor peace agreement be signed. And on its face, those requirements, in our argument, are preempted.
But isn't your argument that just the risk of Chapter 31 being applied it increases the cost of your contractors?
That's not our sole argument, Your Honor.
But isn't it part of it?
It is part of the argument. The fitness test was satisfied, according to the district court. The district court correctly held that where issues of law are presented, the case is quintessentially fit for present judicial resolution under Abbott Labs. We agree with that component of the district court's decision. The second part of the Abbott test requires the court to look at the hardship that has occurred and will occur in the absence of review. And the district court held that MMAC could not meet this requirement because none of its members had been approached. The district court said it may be the case that Chapter 31 never applies to any of your members, the people that you're representing. This is where the district court mistakenly treated the case as exclusively a pre-enforcement case. These are the facts that establish a live case or controversy. Specifically, Chapter 31, as written, requires the contracting agencies, the Department of Aging, Department of Human Services, Department of Administration, to insert into its contracts with contractors a provision that says, where applicable, Chapter 31 must be complied with.
Now, of course, the contracts that the contractors have to sign states that they're not surrendering their rights under federal law.
The contract doesn't say that. Our clients tried to say that.
Well, let's see.
But I thought, following along with Judge Rovner, that they signed the contract with the Chapter 31 language in protest So we don't have any evidence of a voluntary waiver of their rights.
Well, I think part of the harm, Your Honor, that's correct. Factually, that's correct, that our clients took a number of steps to try and evade future enforcement of Chapter 31. But I think one of the key harms here is the fact that they've had to put the waiver issue in play. If you go back factually in terms of how Chapter 31 was enforced against MMAC members, step number one was the agencies putting the language in the contract. In response, our clients did a number of things. Some of them tried to strike the language entirely from the contract as their protest against its enforceability and its lawfulness. Some of them tried to amend it by writing into the contract, we don't agree, this is preempted, this is unconstitutional, so on and so forth. The county responded by saying, no, you can't do that. We won't sign a contract if you're protesting this. And they sent the contracts back with the language as is and said, sign again as is or else you don't get the contract. Some of our clients relented. Some of our clients had no choice for financial reasons to say, okay, we'll do this. Others held on and said, no, we're not going to do this. And the county's response was to withhold payment for services that had been rendered. That created a live, ripe controversy.
But didn't the county ultimately pay those members, though? They were later paid?
In fact, yes, Your Honor. According to the county's affidavits, eventually everyone was paid. The fact that...
Right, and did you present any evidence that the delay in payment was related to the signing of the contract?
I think, the evidence is overwhelming. In fact, if you look at the Smirelli affidavit, Your Honor, which is R37, it goes into detail the steps that Transit Express had to take in its dealings with the county and the reason why the county withheld payment for services rendered. The letter from Gary Portner says, you know why you're not getting paid. You're not getting paid because you didn't sign the contract as is. We don't care that you have for 4 months rendered services to us that we've accepted. We're not going to pay you until you sign a contract. But interestingly, Judge, the contract, going back to this Morelli affidavit and Transit Express originally signed the contract with an amendment saying, we protest. And the county agency signed. Apparently mistakenly, Ms. Stein in her affidavit said, we mistakenly signed that. And when she discovered her mistake, she sent a letter to Transit Express saying, you know what, that contract that you signed and we signed, that's no longer valid. I didn't have the authority to sign that. You have to sign as is, and we're not going to pay you until you do. And this went on and on and on and on until Transit Express was forced under state law to actually file a formal notice of claim, a notice that we're going to sue you, county, for money unless you pay us what you owe us. And it was only at that point that the county relented.
And that's the only member, though, in that situation.
It's the only member that filed a notice of claim.
Right.
I'm sorry.
Go ahead.
There are two others that didn't get paid for services rendered, mm-hmm. Lutheran Social Services and Ladd Lake. They went through the same dance, although to a different degree. In the situation of Lutheran Social Services and Ladd Lake, the county never signed with them by mistake. They just simply wouldn't sign in Lutheran Social Services' case the stricken contract, and in Ladd Lake's case, the amended contract.
Well, of course, you know, at page 12 of Milwaukee's brief, what they argued was, here there is no express waiver. Indeed, LSX, in signing unamended contracts with the county, specifically stated that it, quote, is not intending to waive any rights it may have under any federal or state law. But let me take you to another area, and that's this. If we decide that this case is ripe, why shouldn't we remand it to Judge Adelman for a consideration of the merits? I mean, wouldn't that be more consistent with our limited role?
Judge Rovner, the case has been thoroughly briefed. I can't imagine parties briefing a case more thoroughly than I think the parties have briefed this case before you. The issues presented are purely issues of law that if they come back will be reviewed de novo. There is no factual record that needs to be developed. So what would be the point of sending it back to the district court?
Well, he never reached the merits of the case.
Pardon me?
Did he ever reach the merits?
No.
Well, you know, that's we normally remand for the district judge.
There have been situations where this court has declined to remand issues not reached below where these standards have been met. The case is fully briefed. The issues are purely ones of law, and they're issues that the court reviews de novo. If there's no reason other than simply to hear what the district court has to say on a matter that would be reviewed de novo, I can't see the point, since we're here and the merits are fully briefed, in sending it back to the district court.
I am very curious as to how you interpret Chapter 31 in terms of its reach. In other words, suppose all of a contractor's employees do basically the same type of work. Let's say they're all bus drivers, but that only 20% of them work on county business. If a union approaches the contractor pursuant to Chapter 31 and seeks to organize its employees, does the ordinance apply only to the employees who actually work on county business, or does it potentially apply to all of them?
Well, the ordinance says that it only applies to those working on the contract. The reach is far beyond that. In the hypothetical that you've posed, if these employees work both on county contracts and non-county contracts, which in many situations they do, if you have an organizing effort under Chapter 31 that succeeds and these employees become unionized, they're unionized. The bargaining relationship is as to the county contract, but the reality is that they're unionized. And that relationship, that union relationship, continues under the National Labor Relations Act once the contract ends. If the contractor never gets another county contract, if the contract's terminated in the middle of its term, that's the incredible reach of Chapter 31. It's the gift that keeps on giving. Your Honors,
maybe you want to save the rest of your time.
I see. Yes, I would. Thank you, Your Honor.
Ms. Robbins.
Good morning. My name is Marianne Robbins, and I represent Milwaukee County. I would like to start by drawing the court's attention to certain factual matters that only were placed in issue by MMAC's reply brief. And this also goes to some of the questions about whether it would be appropriate to remand the case. MMAC starts, or not starts, but includes in its reply brief, an issue of motivation. What was Milwaukee County's motivation? Now, I'd like to point out to the court that most courts addressing the question of whether a municipality acts in its proprietary interest have found that it's not appropriate to look into motivation. And I would cite to the court the Colfax versus Illinois State Coal case at 79 F3rd 635 that we cited for another purpose, and the legal aid case 114 F sub 2nd at 237, which both address the fact that we really shouldn't be getting into motivation. But here the county did exactly that, and for that reason I'd like to point out matters in the factual record. And, of course, there could be other matters not in the factual record, but I will stick with the factual record here. If we look at the Selke affidavit and we look at the hearings that occurred before this legislation was passed, or this ordinance was passed, we see that, and that's R32, if we look at Exhibit B, page 3 and 4, we see there was testimony about a labor dispute involving an organizing drive that had disrupted county services among the disabled and elderly, the Parrot Transit area, just in 1999. There is statement, there are statements on Exhibit C, pages 4 and 6, and A on page 4 of the same affidavit, where supervisors talk about the problems that that caused, about a supervisor having to drive a patient to dialysis, and the complaints that were coming in about failure of county residents to obtain services. I would also direct the court to R-58, the affidavit of Mr. Novak.
Of course, it's odd in light of that, isn't it, that none of the unions have, that the unions haven't tried to organize any of these contractors?
Well, Your Honor, as I think Mr. Levine mentioned, there have been organizing drives among some county services, but none of the MMAC members have there been any organizing drives or any requests for...
But see, there's a tension between your mootness argument and your ripeness, whatever you want to call it, and your merits argument, because in your mootness argument, you argue, well, it's entirely speculative whether there's ever going to be a union organization. But on the merits argument, the implication is that union organization is important to avert a dispute. Seems to me you ought to choose one of those.
Well, Your Honor, I don't know that all situations fit with that choice. I would point the court to a situation such as Thomas versus Anchorage Equal Opportunity Commission. I may have the citation is in the brief. It was an ordinance that dealt with unmarried couples and treating them the same as others. Now, the fact that this may have been a concern for an ordinance did not mean that a given group of a given individual landlord or group of landlords would ever, in fact, be faced with this situation. We have the Hayes case involving the city of Urbana. Now, there were concerns.
It's different because in trying to navigate between Gould and Boston Harbor, the court has to determine whether this is a serious effort to deal with operational problems or whether it's just a gesture in favor of unions or against the National Labor Relations Act or what have you. So if there are no actual disputes and no real interest in this, makes you wonder about the motive. But let me ask
you. Well, Your Honor, there are real disputes. There was a real dispute that caused the supervisors to be concerned.
So are you suggesting that pro-union politics or ideology were not a factor in the enactment of this ordinance?
Your Honor, on the one hand, we have a county dealing with...
Yes or no?
It was one... This is a political body, and yes, there were union advocates that supported certain provisions, just as MMAC supported other provisions. Everybody, this is democracy.
No, no, but it's also the question of whether this is case is governed by Gould or by Boston Harbor, right? You understand, that is the issue on the merits. Which of these Supreme Court decisions is controlled?
I agree.
Right. And in Gould, the court thought that given the nature of the law, this was a gesture of, you know, pro-union gesture. It was penalizing firms that had 3 Labor Relations Act violations. In Boston Harbor, they seemed to be operational. Now, is this a mixture, this case?
No, Your Honor. This case is definitely Boston Harbor. And if we get away from the motivation, which I was talking about, and we look at the objective nature of Chapter 31, what we see is that...
But it seems so strange, because...
This does not go beyond the county's
interest. Why would you think that making it easier for unions to organize than the National Labor Relations Act does would reduce the incidence of labor disputes? After all, the idea of the National Labor Relations Act, against the background of serious labor unrest in the early 1930s, was that the scheme that Congress was adopting would minimize labor disputes, strikes and lockouts and all that stuff. So that's what Congress thought. Now, why is it that we or Milwaukee or anyone should think that if you, you know, undo the National Labor Relations Act and have a different balance, that's going to minimize labor disputes?
Your Honor, one specific problem with labor disputes is disruption during organizing drives. That is what the county wants to avoid. The county wants an agreement that if there's an organizing drive, there will be no economic action, there will be no strikes, there will be no picketing, there will be no disruption. That's what the county wants. And if the county can get that, there will not be strikes and picketing and so forth, people not showing up for work, and some kind of boycott, as there was in the paratransit strike.
But
or paratransit organizing drive, I should say. And so that is what the county is attempting to get.
I don't understand. How do you get a strike during an organizing campaign?
People don't show up to work.
That's not a legal strike.
It's not a legal strike? I don't. People don't show up to work?
It's not an unfair labor practice strike, right? So the company can fire the workers. What I don't understand is...
That is not, Your Honor, what we want is... We don't want a situation where...
You're somehow not satisfied with the balance struck by Congress. That's what's puzzling. I could see how you might want to have more labor strife, higher wages, something like that, but I don't understand how you think that jettisoning the National Labor Relations Act leads to greater labor peace.
Your Honor, we are not trying to jettison the National Labor Relations Act. We're saying when
you're
our services...
You've adopted a regime which is inconsistent.
When our services
you've adopted,
are...
You've adopted a regime which is inconsistent with it.
No, we have said when our services are interrupted, we have a right to an agreement that will avoid that happening.
No, there's no interruption.
There is. There was, and there can be. In an organizing drive, that's what Milwaukee County has experienced, is that no one shows up to work. We went from 23 denials within a month to 3 months later during an organizing drive, 1,500 denials of service.
Put it this way. Do the contractors want interruptions in their service?
I'm not concerned about whether the contractors want them or not. Milwaukee County's...
You're not answering my question.
I don't know the motivation of the
contractors want their service interrupted. How can that help them?
I cannot... This is no different from Boston Harbor.
No, it is different from Boston Harbor.
Well, wait. Can I please explain that?
Sure.
In Boston Harbor, you have a general contractor who wants peace, okay? You may have individual contractors who would rather fight it out on wages or recognition or anything else with their employees, but the general contractor's primary interest is in getting the job done. Here, Milwaukee County's main interest is in making sure that the disabled and the aged get their services on time. There may be a contractor who's more interested in not dealing with a union or dealing with a union or in wages or whatever, but the county's interest is we want those services, we want them now, and we want them without any interruption. It's no different. So that's our interest, and we do not want to be in a situation where an individual contractor does not put providing services first. So that's what we've said. Get an agreement so that we're not going to have the problems that we've had in the past. We're not going to have that disruption. You've got an agreement in place.
You're not a general contractor.
It's really very similar, Your Honor. A public employer would always avoid strikes among its employees. Not all private sector employers feel that way, but if you look around the country, you can see most public sector employers feel that way. Well, the county's concern doesn't change because it's dealing with private contractors. It still doesn't want those services interrupted as they have been in the past. And that is a very legitimate concern. We're not concerned...
Okay, wait a second. Let me ask you a question. If we held that this case was ripe, do you agree with Mr. Levine that we should decide it because there are pure legal issues, or would you think it better for us to remand?
Your Honor, as I have seen this case develop, I have seen numerous factual issues come up. I think you have to remand. I also think that there is certainly not a case where there is no doubt as to the result. The discussion we've had about what is the interest of Milwaukee County back and forth here shows how many issues of fact seem to be involved in terms of the ambit of the statute we have a lot of, or the ordinance we have a lot of issues about how far it applies, when it applies. We have speculation about what an arbitrator might find.
I take it you don't agree with Mr. Levine's view of how far it applies, how far the reach is. Is that what you're saying?
I think as he said to begin with, Your Honor, it applies only when, in certain vital services, there actually is an organizing drive, not just somewhere in that employer, but specifically among the employees that are involved in providing the county services. That's one of the ways that you can see objectively that what this is about is avoiding disruption in those services. If
what
you
about
had
the point that once the labor contract is signed, it would persist even after the it lost its contract with the county?
Your Honor, I think if that were to occur, again, we are dealing with speculation, which is inappropriate in a facial challenge as to what would happen in terms of whether the employer would keep them on. I think the reality is, Your Honor, but I don't know. I mean, that's exactly the kind of factual issue that would have to be addressed. You would have a service that is provided to the county, and if the county was not contracting for that service, the employer would not have those employees because it would not be providing that service.
I think it is very unlikely.
It
would still have the employees, would be providing service to someone else and would have a contract with the labor union. I don't see it as a factual question.
Well,
it's a legal question. Wouldn't the contract remain binding on the employer?
The only situation that Mr. Levine mentioned was a situation where the same employees are providing services to the county and to outside the county. There is absolutely no factual record that indicates there is such an employee.
Well,
that there are not separate groups of employees that may be providing different services to different entities, but there is no evidence
from the standpoint of the question, what burden does the contract, what burden does this law place on these companies when they have to decide whether to bid for a contract? They have to figure that if they sign a contract with a labor union and then they lose their county business, they will try to use those same employees for some other purpose.
Your Honor,
if they do so, they're subject to the labor contract, aren't they?
Your Honor, there is no factual record at all that there is any cost to any MMAC member at all. Absolutely none. There is no indication that there is any cost, that there is any difference in the way they treat their employees, nothing. There is not one shred of anything in the record on any impact that this ordinance, Chapter 31, has on them, except at some future date, perhaps and perhaps never. There is nothing about any effect now.
If the union, for instance, wants contact information for employees, would the contractor only have to supply the names of the employees who work on county matters?
Absolutely.
Or must it have to supply the names of all employees?
Just those who are involved in providing the county services.
So if an employee spends 2% of his time on county services, that name would have to go.
Again, now we're dealing with theory. It does not make a distinction, so yes, but that is hypothetical. We have no idea that there is anyone who doesn't spend 100 or 90% of their time or no time. We are again speculating on a facial challenge. This is exactly what we can't do.
I think there is some common sense, you know, in there.
Your Honor, I am not aware of anyone who would have 2% or 5% of their time who would be an employee. That's the kind of thing that is nowhere in this record. We are dealing with speculation. What the county has done is only tried to reach
You would have no objection to a facial review, whether by the district court or by us, which assumed all the facts as favorably to you as possible, then ask whether it's unconstitutional, whether it's either preempted or violates the First Amendment. You couldn't quarrel with that, right?
Right, but that's not what I see happening is a lot of speculation. I would point out that on the standing issue, the plaintiff always bears the burden. That's something that Mr. Levine mentioned earlier.
I don't understand the standing. I mean, the ripeness thing, it seems to me, one deals with by assuming all the facts in your favor, and if it's not unconstitutional under the best assumptions for you, that's fine, and they still would have an as-applied challenge later. That's fine. What I don't understand about your standing position is, clearly for these companies, the county put them through a painful choice. They either give up their county business or they accept Chapter 31 with all sorts of, you know, possible future burdens. Not certain, not anything like that, but it is a costly choice for them. Now, they may all decide that it's better to run the risk of Chapter 31 than to give up their county business. Nevertheless, they're being put in a worse position by being subjected to this risk.
There is no evidence that there is any impact currently. If the court looks at the ripeness cases, there are two ways to deal with hardship. One is that enforcement is certain against you. That is, for example, the City of Urbana case. That's not true. The other item, which I think is what the court is pointing out, is this idea of there's some impact now. We're changing something about the way we do business now. And there is absolutely no evidence of that. At this point, the employer can say anything they want to anybody. There is absolutely no impact on the way they relate to their employees.
Okay, but that's
And there may never be. And there is no economic impact either.
Suppose you said to me that if I wanted to remain as a judge, I would have to sign a contract with you under which there would be a 1% chance that you would guillotine me sometime over the next 10 years. Now, what you're saying is this wouldn't actually impose any present cost on me. If I decide, okay, I'll risk it, I'll remain a judge, you're saying this would be no burden to me because it mightn't
happen.
It's
never a burden.
To me, exactly the same situation for them. There is some probability, probably more than 1%, that a union will come along, Chapter 31 will be triggered, and they'll be in the soup.
Your Honor, if that were true, there would never be a case that wasn't ripe, because there is always some chance that a law is going to apply to you, and we'd have to find every time someone could say, maybe it'll apply to me, we'd have to find all those cases ripe.
This is a situation where you have to distinguish between standing and ripeness. The ripeness inquiry is, do we not know enough to adjudicate this now? The standing inquiry is, has something happened to create a real dispute between the parties? And it seems to me, in my hypothetical case, it may not be right. Maybe there are sort of conditions on this guillotining, so we have to wait. But there is a present burden placed on someone who is subjected to a risk.
The plaintiffs in
risk is a cost to people.
The plaintiffs in Hayes or Thomas would have said the same thing, Your Honor. But my time is up, so
no, not yet.
Oh, okay. Well, as long as the court says so,
I feel like you're at the guillotine. But you know, I mean, suppose we agreed with you that you know the challenge isn't ripe until the union actually approaches one of these contractors. I mean, isn't it fair to assume that the very minute that would occur, the contractors would immediately be back in court seeking an injunction against enforcement? I mean, and what more would we know at that point that we don't already know as we sit here?
I would say two things. First of all, that has not happened. Not MMAC members, but there have been requests for labor peace agreements, and no one has run to court in those occasions. The second item is we would know many, many things that we do not know now. For example, the issue earlier about this hypothetical 2% that, you know, somehow there's going to be someone who's only that's hardly providing services, but that they're going to be involved in this somehow, that they would be included even though most of their services were outside. All of those kinds of issues, whether Mr. Levine has raised issues about what would happen if an arbitrator decided something beyond the minimal provisions, and all of those things we would have answers to, as opposed to where we are now, which is it's just had no impact on anybody who's a member of MMAC.
Okay, thank you very much, Ms. Robin.
Thank you.
And Mr. Levine, how much time did you have? You have a lot of time. You don't have to take it all, though.
Did you say I don't have to take it all, Your Honor?
No.
There are just a couple things that I would like to address.
I'm not trying to rush you. I just meant you should not feel obligated to entertain us for a full 8 minutes.
I'll try to expedite. When the county leans on Boston Harbor, they're leaning on a broken reed. Boston Harbor is not this case. Boston Harbor is a narrow, discrete, factual situation. The Supreme Court said it was. The county can cite no case where a Boston Harbor market participation was found against a law this broad. Also, so there's no mistake about the record, I think counsel indicated that MMAC supported some of the provisions of Chapter 31. MAC supports no provisions and never did support any provisions of Chapter 31.
Does your organization include all of the companies that provide this particular service, that is this for the aged people and so on?
Does MMAC include all those members?
Yes.
No.
So and what percentage? Do you have any idea?
I couldn't fathom a guess, Your Honor.
How many members do you have?
In MMAC?
Yeah.
Hundreds.
You have hundreds? Yes.
Many of them are not county contractors. MMAC is the local version of the U.S. Chamber of Commerce.
Oh, I see. Mm-hmm. So, right, it's not just the...
No.
But do you know how many of these are... How many of your members are... have these contracts?
Dozens. Some of them did not feel comfortable coming forward for obvious reasons, I think. While it is challenging to argue against the principle that a municipal body has an interest in assuring efficient delivery of services to its residents, it's impossible to sanction the county's principle that a municipal body can take any action it seems fit.
Well, what about the emphasis Ms. Robbins laid on a specific dispute that she said precipitated this law, although she admits there are also political factors? So.
With regard to the transit organizing campaign?
If that, I don't remember.
There was what motivated, the law or the unions to get excited about the law was a loss of an organizing campaign at Transit Express and Laidlaw. The county's own council, when asked to review different versions of Chapter 31...
She said there was an interruption of
services. There was no interruption of services. There was no interruption of services.
Wouldn't this be a following up what Judge Rovner had said earlier... Wouldn't it be useful to have Judge Edelman, if we held that there was standing and the dispute was ripe, to look into that Transit Express situation and, in general, look in detail into the background of this law?
No. Because that wouldn't license what the county has done here. If the county was serious about making sure there are no organizing interruption in service due to organizing disputes, ban union organizing of county contractors. How's that? That's a straight line between two points. And if the county's right that Chapter 31 is not preempted, they've got the authority to do that. Think of the different types of provisions that the county
could impose. No, your arguments are okay, but the question is, would there is some tension between Gould and Boston Harbor, so wouldn't it be helpful to us, maybe we're just being cowardly, wouldn't it be helpful to have Judge Edelman analyze this. As you say, review would be de novo, but you still can get help. I mean, you know, get help from the briefs, even though we obviously don't defer to them. So why wouldn't it be helpful to see what he has to say about this?
Well, we know that facially, I guess my point is that you have Chapter 31. It says very specific things. You have the National Labor Relations Act. It says very different things.
They're clearly inconsistent. That's not the problem. The problem is Boston Harbor permits this sort of reverse preemption. And the question is whether Milwaukee County has something analogous to a general contractor's interest in intervening in the labor relations of its subcontractors to make sure the service is implemented.
As long as it's done in a narrowly focused, ad hoc way. The county could act like normal proprietors in the real world, which is if you've got a supplier of parts, typically what you'll do is you'll negotiate a provision in your contract with the supplier of parts that says, you know what, if there's a labor dispute that gets in my way, I can terminate this contract. That's normal, typical market participation.
That's not always satisfactory, because if you terminate a subcontractor and you don't have, I mean, that was the Boston Harbor problem, right? You don't want, it's fine to be able to terminate a subcontractor, but that may also delay your project. So you may want to prevent the occurrence of the situation would force you to terminate.
Well, facilitating, as you pointed out, Judge Posner, facilitating union organizing has the complete opposite effect. I've been doing traditional labor law for 15 years. There's never been a strike that I'm aware of involved in any of my cases or, frankly, any other cases during a union organizing campaign. The reality is the county says that employees can't strike under Chapter 31. That's just not true. Under Section 7 of the National Labor Relations Act, non-union employees have the right to engage in a strike over their wages, hours, and working conditions. And that right can only be waived by the employees themselves or their designated representatives, neither of which is the case under Chapter 31. The county's under the impression somehow that it can mandate that either employees waive this right, or maybe they're just telling unions that they can't call a strike. But the reality is that if employees are unhappy because an employer is engaging in some sort of speech related to a campaign, they can walk.
I don't want you to tell us anything that isn't in the record. But I have been wondering whether the NLRB was contacted by either side. If it's not in the record, just don't tell.
It's not in the record.
Okay.
It's not in the record. Okay. The reality is, though, is that local government is under pressure by organized labor to make union organizing easier. These ordinances, or attempts at these ordinances, are popping up all over the place. They're not succeeding. The most recent attempt was 3 weeks ago, where the court in California, in the Lockyer case, was asked to look at a California statute that said, you know what, if you're receiving state funds and you're on state property, you can't use those funds for organizing purposes to influence the result of an organizing campaign. The district court in that case correctly held that's preempted, that's nowhere near a Boston Harbor case. I do want to focus on the absurd results of accepting the county's arguments in this case. The range of ordinances that the county could pass, this is just a short list. Employees working for private employers providing goods or services to the county may not unionize. Employees working for private employers providing goods or services to the county may not strike. Employers that provide goods or services to the county must use their best efforts to defeat any union organizing effort. My time is up. Thank you, Your Honors.
Okay, thank you very much to both sides.